Absolutely, you know, one of the things that we, with God Belongs in our county, brought us together.
This is John Cargo from Caro, New York. I'm the president of the Caro Historical Society, and you're listening to WGXC Acura 90.7 FM Hands On Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Tony at Large. Tune in to the Eclectomaniac Radio Show for a fun, sexy mix of new hits, throwbacks, and remixes. Third Wednesday of the month from 7 to 9:30 p.m. only on WGXC 90.7 FM Acra. Love is the answer. Tune in.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
Hello, good afternoon. This is WGXC that you're listening to, and we are in Columbia, Greene counties in New York State, Acra, Hudson, and Catskill. And we're also global on WGXC.org, streaming live. And I'm your host for this hour. This is the Art of the Hudson. And I'm your host, Chad Weckler. And today we have two wonderful guests, Columbia County residents. We have Donald McKinney and Kenneth Polinski. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good to be here. Chad.
Thank you.
So the program, you call it The Beat Goes On.
That's right.
And how would you explain that title?
Well, besides just inventing it at the spur of the moment, as I do most things, hi, listeners, I'm excited because I have wanted to do a radio interview and a little bit more with Donald about his past. Mm. And we met in 1973, and we have experienced so many things in the art world, I mean, including being up in Columbia County. But I was happy that you were very open to the idea of hearing both of us together, not me as just an artist, but the two of us as travelers in the art world for over 45 years. And so I'm happy that Donald is here. I hope Donald McKinney is happy he's here.
I believe I am.
We'll find out.
We'll find out. Yeah.
I'll misspeak, and he won't. So hang in there, everybody.
So let's start, Donald. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about your background, where you're from, and what you've been involved with?
Well, I was born in Manhattan. Number one. And I went to Columbia and then university, and from there I ended up in London for 7 years. In fact, I went to the court hall for a while. I found myself at one point without any funds at all, and I just had to get a job, and I knocked, I was told that there was an opportunity at Marlborough, which was then the strongest gallery in the world, and they hired me the next day.
Wow.
And Donald's background was in hung around the Queensborough Public Library and books, so in a way his story is also a bibliophile's journey because he loves books. So he was hired by Marlborough Gallery to sort out their catalog. It was a very innocent job, which led to him being the only American in the London gallery which led to?
At that point, I was there a very short time, but never. In fact, my first exhibition that I worked on was Corot of all, 19th century. And then they represented Henry Moore, et cetera. And I was asked to work on with Jackson Pollock because they had just taken the estate in Europe. And wow. At that point, Lee Krasner, his wife, was not ready to commit a gallery to his work in New York. She really wanted, at one point, the Museum of Modern Art just to take all the work, but that didn't happen at that point. They told her to go and look for a gallery. So she ended up, I being American, and it just worked out. They introduced me to her, and we got to be very, very good friends, and I worked with her for 19 years. And I did the first exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in 1966. I worked on that very...
Of Pollock's work.
Of Pollock's work.
In the beginning, did you go to Pollock's studio?
Oh, yes, yes. We went to... we went to Springs quite often. In fact, Kenny came with me once or twice.
Later, when we met, we would go out to the Springs in the summer. And Lee would have her work transferred from the 79th Street apartment. She had a bedroom studio, which inspired me later to have a bedroom studio. But she, every summer, would transfer, have the truckers come and move her paintings out to the Springs. And I was a shipper for the gallery and a registrar at the time. So we would go out, and then we'd wait for Donald after the delivery. And by the way, the whole... Lee Krasner was remarkable and loving and always would have chicken stew ready for us when we came out. But Donald would arrive, and remarkably, the exchange was so filled with trust that whatever he would advise her to do with a painting, she subsequently did do, which led her to the large paintings exhibition at the Whitney in 1975.
Hers.
And she, is that true?
Yes, her work, yes.
Of Lee's work. So Lee started to step out of the cloak of being Jackson Pollock's widow into becoming, at that time in the 70s, a very rare thing, a woman artist in her own right.
She took over his studio.
Yes.
But she covered the floor. So all the drips that where he worked would always be there and not her paint. She was very respectful for her husband's work.
That was very smart.
Yeah, but she needed a place to work. She always worked upstairs in the bedroom when he was alive. And then he found, they both worked in the house. It was a simple farmhouse, more or less, in Springs. Mm. And eventually he took over this barn, and he worked there. And in fact, years later, after I was on the Pollock catalog raisonné that took place, and there was a point where there was an outhouse that was covered in vines in the back, and she would always say, "Don't go near it, it's going to fall down, it's going to fall down." Well, soon, at one point, years later, I guess she was going to take it down, and they found a rolled-up Jackson Pollock in there. Hmm. And so...
And at what year might this be?
Well, she had gone... This would be around... I wasn't... Around in the...
Are you referring to the discovery of the painting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. It was later. It was in the... It was in
yeah,
the,
it was later. It was after her death, or...?
No. It was still... Okay. Still, she was alive. I think it was in the late 70s that she did that.
It's good that we're talking about Lee Krasner, because the transition for someone in a studio, as tragic as the loss of Jackson was, it also provided her with an opportunity to grow as her own artist. And I that's the part I saw. Donald was, of course, there earlier, when I met Dahl in 73, I was just watching Lee Krasner become her own person.
Those were the days it was very, very difficult for a woman painter. They just didn't have an opportunity. Even Helen Frankenthal, all of them.
And her despised nemesis, Louise Nevelson. And there were a handful of women artists at that time. And today, when you think of it, it almost seems outrageous. But it took generations for a painter like Florine Stettheimer in the 1920s and 30s to get a museum retrospective at the Whitney last year.
And she was Stettheimer was then a very good friend of...
Duchamp,
for instance.
And everyone else. But her work was not taken seriously, and she was not taken seriously because she had a nice apartment, and she was considered a society dame and not a serious painter. And so the evolution of looking at women's work and, minority works by minorities has really come out of that 70s shift, as we were talking about the viewpoint of towards photography in the early 70s. It was unheard of for photography to be taken well, except for maybe Muybridge and a few exceptions, and Ansel Adams. It was an exception to see
Man Ray, probably.
Man Ray, yes. Oh, well, there was more than a handful, but for it to be the public to embrace it as a fine art form, really, it started when Donald started the Richard Avedon show at the Marlborough Gallery. That was a big splash, and then he represented the work of Irving Penn.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier before we came on air,
right,
and I went to the Marlborough Gallery in 77. I was working practically next door at the Carnegie Hall and working for a photographer.
Oh.
And when I saw that show, and Irving Penn is my favorite all-time photographer,
right.
That was a wonderful...
That was my first exhibition of it. Yeah, in the gallery.
Because he had the cigarette butts, but also...
Oh, the cigarette butts. So we had a show before the cigarette butts, it's true.
But yeah, the cigarette butts sort of put him into another realm, but it was the early portraiture, I think.
Oh,
it was
love
the
that.
First show, mm-hmm. yeah. And then the bakers and everybody against the blank screens and the lighting. When I'd like to ask you, what do you love about him, about Irving Penn's photography?
I love two aspects. One is the portraiture, and the other, I love his color still lifes.
Mm-hmm.
Quite different.
Very different.
In their detail.
Do you see a relationship between photographers like Robert Mapplethorpe and that came later, and Peter Huyar, and these photographers that started to really use it exclusively as fine art expression? Do you see the relationship to Irving Penn?
I do, and Annie Leibovitz is also in that realm, but they're all different.
Well, your next door neighbor here from is Lynn Davis.
Yes.
And she was also an artist that I helped over the years.
Donald, how did you find all these wonderful artists?
Oh, I found her work when I was in Europe, believe it or not, here. And she was in some kind of exhibition that someone had put together. I was German
in Carson Greb Gallery?
No, he wasn't. Carson Greb took her on after I had shown her. Mm. And she was just among in this group, and I liked what I saw, and I immediately, got back to America and got in touch with her. And she was very concerned. She had these very, very large photographs, and it was very hard to find a dealer that would show them, because there would be some cost involved. And I decided to commit my funds to see that work done, because it was extraordinary work.
Were those mostly the large landscapes and icebergs and monuments?
Yes, icebergs and the pyramids and that period.
A recent New York Times article went back and looked at her portrait work that mm-hmm. she started doing, and in relationship to Mapplethorpe, she did a lot of she photographed me when I moved up here in 1993. She was renting the old Rowell studio in Hudson when she purchased her studio, and she had the natural light coming in through the skylight in the building right up the block here, and is now an antique shop, of course. But she did a portrait. She was doing portraits of everybody in town, including John Ashbery and everybody. And I had moved my studio, closed my studio in Tribeca, and I had just moved up, and she did. And I was not a good sitter, but she was very patient with me. But Donald did change her career as well. She became really taken seriously. And
more international.
International dealers looked at her seriously, and she's thrived ever since, I think.
Well, it's how do you get the exposure that an artist needs? I mean, besides having a prestigious gallery that you're showing in, I would imagine the curator of the gallery has a following of having a pulse, finger on the pulse of what people are interested in or should be exposed to. What was your technique?
I wouldn't call it a technique. It's something that just excites me. I just feel that I'm looking for something that's individual and not part of a school. And I guess my career started with the school, the New York school, or abstract expressions, whatever.
Franz Klein. Call them.
I handled Franz Klein's work for a period of years, and Clifford Still, and of course, and Mark Rothko.
Reinhardt.
And Rothko is an interesting talk about studios. When I met him, he had just taken on the DeMille. Of the DeMille Chapel in Houston, and he had done these very large paintings, and he had just had a problem with his wife, and he moved to live on East 69th Street.
An old carriage house.
North Lexington, yeah. Mm. And it was an extraordinary building. It was built by a very rich man at one point for his children to ride horseback in the building and learn side saddles, etc.
Wow.
And anyhow,
it was a large studio. It looked like a gymnasium.
With a balcony, yes. And ironwork. It was extraordinary. And he just had a simple cot in there and a kitchen and these enormous paintings. And he had a large canvas seal covering the skylight, and I'm bringing that up only because later on, when the paintings were finally done after his death, they were
installed,
and they found that the light in the chapel was too strong. Texas sunlight was very different than New York sunlight, and it just ruined the paintings. I mean, ruined it in terms of visually. And they, the DeMilles spent a lot, redid their whole ceiling, everything else trying to. Philip Johnson was the originator of that space for the DeMilles. And then I think someone else took it on because there was some quarrel.
In the Texas Chapel.
In the Texas
Donald,
Chapel.
You brought up something interesting. We once we saw a Cy Twombly show in Spain, in the old greenhouse. Do you remember that?
Yes.
That vast greenhouse. And Donald had installed a notable show in Venice at the Ca Pizarro?
Yes.
Yes. And it hadn't been used for exhibitions very much at that time. Now Venice is practically, a commercial center for...
We're talking about Rothko.
Rothko. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about what Twombly's work looked like in the natural setting underneath the natural glass of a greenhouse. And what Donald had done is arrive in Venice and found that the old Palazzo's windows were filthy. And it was unheard of at that time, and I believe you said you did it on your own. He removed the soil from the window in order to illuminate Mark Rothko's paintings with natural Venetian light, and the results were a sensation.
Then Tom Hess, who was considered, I don't know if you remember that name, but he was a great critic, and he was the editor of Art News, I believe, for many years, and he was a great collector. And he said, he wrote in the New York Times, or something, I believe, that it was probably the most exciting visually show it's seen anywhere at any time.
It elevated Rothko.
Because it was just the reflection of the water just came through and hit the paintings. And, just the reflection, it just moved. And it made his paintings just vibrate.
I find that interesting of the studio versus a gallery setting.
Yes.
And what you are trying to do.
Yeah, sometimes, you go to a studio and the venue, it's very difficult because the artist often is not pleased when you get them onto their walls because it's just a total different.
You mean when they're installed in a commercial setting?
In a commercial setting.
As opposed
setting,
to their
all, you
the
know,
natural
the white walls. I mean, when I was with David Hockney for quite a few years, he would hate the white walls, and we would paint them a deep red or sometimes a Mediterranean blue or something because that's what he felt comfortable about. And so you would, the gallery often had to alter in order to really exhibit the work at their best.
Yes, and then I witnessed artists who were more than willing to double and triple stack their work. Donna worked with David Hockney for a time, and there was a few other painters in the 70s, and they wanted it to look like what it was before it left their studios. And the studio environment was why I had really contacted you when I relocated my studio from Hudson into a light-filled train station in Claverick. I think it was Donald who came in and said something about how the work had changed from what it was.
Changed in what way, Donald?
The spirit of the work. It was. It just looked fresh and new, and I think it's the way people hang a painting somehow, It just, it changes its character when the different environment, the painting changes.
Well,
I
of course,
think.
The light source, too, don't you
think?
Yeah,
the light source. And I used to remember today everybody who gets these, $40 million paintings, and they put these spotlights and hitting the painting. Often it destroys them, but nevertheless, that's what they do. But I remember when I used to go and visit.
We worked on lighting a lot, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
A client, and they would just have a standing lamp, and they would take it, some of the great collections, and they would just take their standing lamp and hold it so I could see the paintings. But, everything. I think it's more important to make them look more natural. And one thing that an old friend of Bunny Mellon said, you're not supposed to see anything. You're not supposed to see any changes. Everything should be that you'd not noticed. And even when you have important paintings, which they did, for instance, there was none of that. It was just the paintings, without just the light of the room.
Doesn't that exemplify the East Wing in the National Gallery, that really they relied on natural light in most of the installation of their Diebenkorns and all their other works, And I think what you brought up was that the art world now has a more stylized presentation, and what we're talking about is something a little more antiquated, which was that the less you did, the better in terms of presenting a work of art. And you mentioned about success and all that. I've had what I consider a moderately successful, unsuccessful career. I've done what I've wanted to do, and I think being in the midst of a high-powered career where you're not in control of every aspect of it anymore is very disconcerting as well. Success comes with a price. But what I am trying to say to you is that how to hang a painting is an artist sort of will turn that over, and that may work for some artists, and some artists it may be that they need to take responsibility for how their work is perceived.
I remember going back, he just mentioned Diebenkorn, and again, one of my artists.
And a studio.
And Diebenkorn moved his studio to Santa Monica, and he did these, and he couldn't paint once he made the move. He couldn't work in that the new studio. And he just went, he said, I go in every single day, and he had a big old leather chair, and he would sit in and just look at what the work that he had done before, and it's just standing there. But he says, I just couldn't work. I didn't feel comfortable in that environment. Mm. And eventually, he broke it, and he started working on an old painting, and then he got back into the thing. But it just didn't, you know, this idea of bigger and artists always looking for the biggest gallery to show their work, sometimes that's not the way to go.
But studios can do that too. They can intimidate as well as inspire. Right? Yeah,
yeah. There's an interesting book that Jill Kremens did, photographing writers in their writing environment.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're all different. They're all, you know, it's where you feel comfortable. So I guess the same is, you know, for artists too. Yeah. Do you find that most artists who paint work with natural light, or do some use artificial lighting?
I think it's very arbitrary. I mean, it just depends. Some people don't.
There isn't a rule, I think.
Some don't like natural light at all, you know. Particularly the ones who work with flat colors and things like that.
Yeah, you're talking about running the gamut. If someone is painting plein air outside and doing landscape work, and someone who's doing very internalized collage or introspective work. When I mix them both up, and that was a big shock in the new studio. I had natural light. And I could see, this is so funny, because I could see, I paint with, I don't use pen, I paint lines with a brush, and I really consider my work, the drawings, brush paintings. I couldn't see them anymore in the old studio, and when I got to the new studio, I was able to really see some of the marks I was making in a different way. So I do combine intense studio lamps with natural light. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say what a rule is, but I think if you really look, you probably will see it in the work itself.
And Kenny, how did your work, have you, since you've seen this change,
yes,
have you altered it in any way in the new space?
Donald might testify to this radically, but within my language and structure of my work and the context that I try to keep, the unnatural representation of the natural, and I have just recently seen the effect. And I always work on preliminary drawings to make sure I really like what I'm doing, and I had done one that was, in fact, like, all right, it was remarkable. I was surprised. And it was of an image that I had very little faith in it becoming, and it was Donald just bought me a new giant sketch pad for my birthday, so I did this preliminary sketch, and it was so disconcerting to see a change come about from the environment that I couldn't really work on it until very recently. And now the marks that I make, as I mentioned, was not quite clarity, but there's a, what do you think of the giant hatched bird drawing?
You know, I think it's extraordinarily good.
See, he thinks it's extraordinary.
And do the...
Yes, so there's a change.
Yeah, do the two of you collaborate in the sense of you...
Well, yeah, sometimes I look at something and I'm very, can be picky-unish about something. I mean, I just look at it and I know something's really good, and I say, but maybe if this could just be a little... You could tweak this a little bit or alter this a little bit, but... I don't do that really very often.
No, but you're very, because of our partnership and our love for each other. He's been doing that since I met him, I switched from surrealist paintings when I was very young into naturalistic watercolors, and he has been there every step of the way with me. So he that's again why I wanted to be here, because I think a good collaborator, and he is a collaborator because he has a lot of experience, and he has what's called a good eye. He has a remarkable eye, but sometimes he'll say, you know, that could use a little gray wash on it, and I'll go ballistic, and then when he leaves, I'll fix it. You know, but relying on someone's judgment is important. You know,
well, Donald, when you're working with artists for a gallery show, what's the process with you and the artist?
Usually, you're like, well, just take an artist that lives, say, a distance. So normally I would get a message saying, or speak to them on the telephone saying, could you come? They're also, generally they're scheduled for an exhibition. And it's probably a year before that exhibition, I'd certainly go and visit.
There's a lot of downtime.
And then, then there's the matter of looking at the work, and also it's sometimes elimination because there's too much work, and the artist said, you must take this, you must take that, and I say, well, that's not possible. We just can't take it.
Donald
and
is
my feelings is always to make to make it the most exciting. And one time I did... we took on Clifford Still, and Clifford Still was known and was a very, very difficult man. Mm. But somehow we made a connection. But I was somewhat terrified of him at one point. And he would come. He would do all sorts of things, spy a little bit to find out what I was doing and how I was doing it, and you know. But there's something underneath that I liked about him a great deal. Anyhow, so I put up this, I had a group of 12 very important paintings of his, something like that, and I tried to make them play and work with each other, and it was a major, first Clifford show exhibition in years, and it was an important one, and he... all of a sudden, he got off the elevator, and coming through, and I heard this yell something, and it was him. he was excited, and I was so surprised because he doesn't get excited. He doesn't get normally it's a negative reaction from him. So
Donald brought up two issues you mentioned about. How an artist's career will develop, and he was notorious, at least in my mind, because I watched him do it with the John Marin estate, where he edited out work that he considered weakened the stronger work, and it is painful to have someone tell you that you have too many drawings and not all of them making a statement. So he's an editor, and he's ruthless about it. And artists are reluctant to actually edit out. And everything I do is brilliant. Well, it may be, but it may not make a strong show. So I met Donald when I was installing for Marlboro Gallery. I was installing the exhibition. So that's how we developed our relationship. Lighting, placement. Editing, taking a painting out of a show, those kinds of judgments, is somebody like Donald can do that and improve the work in a sense. And it's hard for artists to admit it, but when you sometimes remove, I knew a painter, I still do, from the 80s, Gregory Aminoff, and he used to say, take away 10%. I've always tried to listen, to keep that in mind. To have some restraint in drawing and in my own work, but more importantly with a career, take away 10%. So there's always a little held back, and Donald always did that.
And artists do need that. And as an artist myself, I think...
You're a photographer.
Photographer, and maybe I'll submit to a gallery or a show, and I think, wow, this is going to be perfect, fitting in, and then it doesn't get picked, and I just say, oh, well, that's okay. all the jurors or the curators, they're all different personalities and they have their own instincts of what they see in a gallery. So I trust that. And I personally, when I've had shows, I had one at the community college, a solo show, and I just gave them the prints and they put them up on the walls, and I totally trust them, and it
yes,
much better than I can do.
Yes.
To find the colors and the contrast and put them in a story.
One of my last exhibitions in Hudson was at the Hudson Opera House. And in fact, that was actually curated by Donald and myself. And I think also Nicole Fiacco, who was once my dealer in Hudson, she came in to help. And it was a self-curated exhibition, and it was pretty good. But I couldn't rely on my own judgment. When you have someone as experienced as Donald McKinney...
You're so lucky to have Donald.
Thank you. He didn't say that about you.
I'm lucky to have him, I'll tell you. So many ways.
You're a wonderful team.
Thank you.
In many ways.
It's very nice of you to have me on again, because I have been on in the past talking about Winter Walk or talking about working with children or another exhibition, and it's very nice to be with you again. I hope your listeners understood the point that we were trying to make, is that a life in art is so I wanted to share it because it is so rich and enriching. And with someone like Donald, when we go into a museum, it's practically an event. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people gather around us to listen to us babble, which is flattering but annoying. But in fact, expertise does matter in a way, you know.
I want to bring up something because it's important for your listeners, that, and what you brought up, it's an artist taking their work to a gallery.
Mm.
There's so many things that can happen, but they often are, say, I've come to you because you're showing all the kind of things that I feel close to, and it's like my work. Well, they may not be interested in more.
Why would they want another one?
The same, you see. And it's very important, and not ever when you, it's really important not to get discouraged when they say, you know, we like your work, but. And, you know, we try to look some. I often, for years, suggested other places. In fact, most of the time I did. We would sit, I did once a week, go through.
Yes, you did.
The artists who had came to us, and then I would sit down with them eventually and tell them why and where their work would
yes,
be.
Yes, he really did that.
But younger artists or artists who have not exhibited often should go to a place with galleries that are on that level, because the collectors have a tendency to go to those galleries because that's what they're looking for.
To be maybe find a discovered artist.
But most of the artists that I've known, I mean, the great ones, there are moments, like you mentioned John Maron. Well, there was a point when John Maron, there was nothing going on for John Maron for years, basically. I mean, well-known, et cetera, but nothing. And I took his work and made it, I presented it in a way that it would look fresh, and it was fresh to people. So there's it's always they should always have the opportunity to show it again.
One of the things you brought up, and if viewers are listening, it may be a lot of artists who are interested in a career like Donald's, and peer, it's really about peer referral. And usually a dealer will listen, if he has an artist that he's working with, he'll listen to that artist. So make friends with artists, which is difficult to do sometimes, but to be supportive of another artist's work and have them supportive of you is really one of the key if there's such a thing as networking, it's really having the support of your peers, and that can open some doors a little bit.
And a critic, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've had, you know, John Yao, and I've had articles written, and I had an excellent article written by the Berkshire Eagle, and that doesn't always sell the bill of goods, you know. It's a really lovely thing to have.
It's reassuring that someone understands your work.
That one was from the Opera House show, and that was remarkable. But did it bring people banging at my door? Well, frankly, no. And so there is no magic bullet to finding an audience. It really is perhaps the most difficult thing to do, besides concentrating on your own work. But to find an audience that you talk to and resonate with is a great accomplishment. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just trying to what I was trying to think of before was just to say that all artists should not give up. The point is, there are time, and all my experiences, there'll be a moment when the world will look at the work and think, you know, that this is, he has something to offer.
If you stay at it.
You just stay at it, and it may be a very long time, but it will happen. If it's good work, it will come to people's attention, and you'll be in your museums and et cetera. And in fact, too early success means probably... a few years and then goodbye.
and you also worked with Keith Haring.
Yes, I did. Yes.
How did that come about, and what did you do?
The estate came at somebody in the art world brought the estate to you, didn't they?
Well, it was
no.
I think it was a lawyer. No, who sort of got called to my attention, and they were looking for someone to handle it. And
Mayor Bloomberg also wanted to install Keith Haring's Up and Down Park Avenue.
Yes, I did that exhibition.
What was the art fund, the public art fund, and Donald curated that entire. It was a sensation.
That was unfortunately a long story, but I was long gone at Marlborough, and I was with the Andre Enrich Gallery, and I took Keith Haring with me and the estate, and they wanted to do this, and we had to work for Matt Katz, and we transferred to Sotheby's. Sotheby's wanted to own a gallery. Big mistake for everybody. But anyhow, Sotheby's was very against it until the head of Sotheby's did some math on a piece of paper and with their whole board and decided this could be a good deal. And of course it was a good deal. They made a lot of money from it. But it took a lot of persuasion. Their mind was not in terms of really exposing an artist's work or anything. Art was selling art, period.
And how does the pricing of artwork
how does it evolve?
Yeah, the process. That must be very difficult.
It is, but you work within a structure that's always been, that's there, like, say, unknown artists start with this, or you just feel what the traffic can bear, quite and
right.
Then,
exactly.
And of course, I worked with Lee for many years with Pollock, and with Lee, Pollock would have to be the highest price over Rothko, over Klein, over Clifford Still, etc. But the point was, there was a certain, and we worked that price structure, but it's you work in their relationship where they are at, and
I remember
and also what the market.
I remember a remarkable transition with the English painter Francis Bacon, and the late Henry Gutzeller, who was a resident of Hudson, early resident of the new people in Hudson. He curated an exhibition. I think it was one of the first major shows, and I was helping import the paintings into America, and they had to be glazed immediately. They always had glass in front of them. And his paintings were, the triptychs were, I think, $50,000 on a Monday. And after the show opened, they went to $500,000. Mm-hmm. So there is this energy that can't quite be explained, and when someone else comes in and wants to invest, as all of a sudden a painter, I mean, I'm a modestly priced painter, you know, under $10,000, and I'm yours, you know. But there are painters with large reputations and track records, and all of a sudden that will just flip. And in Francis Bacon's case, it was remarkable. And I saw that happen to several careers. I think Alex Katz is a good example of someone who was sitting dormant and appreciated, and then Hilton Kramer did an astounding review of his installation at Marlborough Gallery in the early 70s when I was there, and his career just changed within moments, really. And it was such a praise and lavish analysis of his work that what he was, which was recognized in the vein of what was Porter or Neil Welliver, he suddenly jumped the gun and he became a pop naturalist artist. You know, he became something else. And that happened in a very brief period. So you know, supply and demand, in a sense, for all of it, it applies to the value of a piece of art, which can go up and down, something that was worth $50,000 last month may not get that at auction. It may get a fraction of that. It's very hard to know.
Donald, that praise or that success of an artist's work, can that ruin an artist sometimes?
Yes, it could. And I think of one artist that happened.
Can you say it?
No, I don't want to mention his name. That would be
Augie.
He died. But John Russell saw his exhibition. He was an abstract artist.
John Russell?
Yes, and he was the art critic for the New York Times. And he wrote a very, very strong article on this painter, his exhibition. Don't say his name.
No, I'm not doing anything, Donald.
And the point was that, so, the artist said, I really want an exhibition. Then two years later or so, he said, I really want an exhibition, but I want John Russell to review it. And he said, did John Russell come by? And John Russell come by? And said, I'm going to call John Russell. And he went on like that. And finally, John Russell said, all right, you want me to do it? I'll do it. And he butchered him the second time around. And that was the end of his career.
Wow.
And his paintings went up at auction, and they went for 15% of their value.
It's interesting because this anonymous painter, what was taken to task was over-explaining. His work, every painting had a large essay attached to it to the side, and you might recall at one point I was doing fable stories, and I would add a little poem or explanation of what the drawing was about, and I've withdrawn that because the memory of that artist being criticized, if your work doesn't pass on information and a story or whatever it is you're trying to say, and you have to put up a blurb to explain it, maybe that's not so good.
It's,
you know,
best not to say.
It's best to keep a lid on it. Let them figure it.
A good example was Kitai, because this has all been out in the public. He had an exhibition. And
an American who was an English expat.
He's considered part of what they call the London School.
R.B. Kitai.
R.B. Kitai. And very interesting painter, but he had his big retrospective, and he put statements next to the paintings, what they meant, and the critics ripped into them. The critics did not want him to tell him what his paintings meant.
And he was held in high regard up to that point.
And then it destroyed his. That did it, and that was the end of his career. And his wife, he went into deep depression, and his wife died, and he blamed the death of his wife on that exhibition.
Listeners, we're getting some good advice.
Donald was very helpful. I just wanted to end with, and this is a shameless promotion, but Donald had encouraged me to continue. I was prepared to leave the studio in Hudson after 20 years. I was on the third floor. And I decided to set up a new studio in at Stair Restoration's property. And there's the old train depot that was used as an antiques warehouse. And I saw it last year, and the owner, Colin Stair, was very kind. And I decided that you have to move forward even though you don't know what forward looks like. So I want to pass that on to your listeners too, that sometimes if you are in fact committed and you do love what you're doing, the blind faith is very, very necessary. And Donald was instrumental in telling me, no, you know, you could throw the, you could stop and end everything, but what will you be like and will you be happy?
And his work is better now than it's ever been.
Thank you.
And so there is no formula, no set formula for success. And you say this is what you got to do. You got to do any of that. But it's what you do with your work.
It's hard to do.
And the point is, don't look at too much of other people's work, the ones that are succeeding. Be yourself.
If you compare your insides to someone's outsides and you think they're more successful or getting more attention, the only effect that will have is stifling your creativity and creating a resentment and creating an environment that is not conducive to really concentrating and doing your work your way. Is it hard? That's the only thing about... that's the aspect of fine art career, is that the enormous independence is also a great responsibility. And I've had, as you know, I had we owned an antique business in Hudson. I had a catering company in New York. I've always had to supplement what I'm passionate about. And of course, having a partner like Donald, being supportive in all ways, made an enormous difference. So I wind up at this time in my life feeling uniquely like an artist who has held on to being an artist in itself is an accomplishment, a career accomplishment, you know. And we're going to celebrate the new studio. I'm going to put it on my Facebook page, and it'll be the Sunday of Columbus Day weekend. And I will do a talk and a brief papermaking demonstration out in Claverick. And I'll put that, I'll send that link back to you.
That'd be great.
Okay.
And what's the date, Kenny?
So far it's Sunday, October 7th, 1 to 5 p.m. And so it's a celebration of not only me, showing off me, but really a celebration of allowing your story to continue and allowing there to be another chapter. And that's what Donald and I have after 44 years of being partners and spouses.
I would love to know. I would bet your home is full of antiques, books, and art.
Oh, of course it is. It's so spectacular.
Who's the strongest curator who put that together of the two of you?
Our home is very interesting. It really is an expression of us. It's not as spectacular as you just made it sound. But I'll go with that.
Oh, darn.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
We had
homes like that.
Most people in life, we've had our ups and downs, and many of the art was sold. But most of the books, which we have thousands, I would say.
First editions.
And among other things. And the books are still there. We have an abundance of Kenny Polinsky, so we have plenty of those. We've moved a few times, so we have furniture from different periods of our lives. It's not especially planned, you know.
It's eclectic.
Well, I think when Donald was at the heyday, the height of his career, and we relocated to the large home in Livingston from Barrytown, and that it was a large Greek Revival house. And I guess the description you just gave would be more apt to that residents, because at that time there was more income coming in for both of us. And so there's a tendency when you have a little more income not to deassess as much, you know. And so it was a home that represented our lives at that time. And it was, some people would come in to visit for the weekend and never stop looking at anything, you know. But our home now in Claverick is a home, a real home. And there's a little bit of this and that from our careers, and just enough. There's some things that we would never let go of, and Donald has a collection of museum posters that represented each phase of his life. And he had the Jackson Pollock, still does, the Jackson Pollock Museum of Modern Art from 1967 poster, and a Cy Twombly sign poster, you know. So it represented each phase of what he did in his career. So those are not market stunning, valuable things, but they're personal and they're part of our story, you know.
Most of it's personal.
Yeah. It's personal.
Not
yeah.
so much in terms of dollars.
I have the crappiest toy collection now, which could drive me crazy, but I saved a few things that were sentimental. And as you do, as you probably, most of your listeners, as you age, objects can become burdensome as well.
I totally agree. And Donald, are you retired, or are there still some things you'd like to do?
I like to be retired.
Yeah?
I like it. It's a wonderful work. No, I was, for many, many years, I was concerned about everybody, all my artists. And no matter where they came from, to where they were, success, even though they're great success, they still need a tremendous amount of help. And so it's big relief not to have to worry about them anymore. It really
your
is.
Your children.
they were my children. I had an awful lot of children. So I kind of like the idea of just, picking up a book, doing what I want to do.
Well, also, you had a very high pressured, demanding career. I mean, we traveled the globe installing exhibitions for art fairs in Europe and France and in Switzerland. So his career also took a great toll on him, where there would be times when I'd have to call him and tell him the peonies in the garden are blooming, and he'd be away.
Time to come home.
I've never seen them for years.
Then I traveled for papermaking in Europe, and I taught papermaking in Latvia for 2 weeks, believe it or not. And then I met him in Switzerland, where we did art shows, and then traveled, and we were out of the country for weeks at a time. And I think both of us tend to want to sit still in some ways, and with my studio nearby, he's able to have a quiet day, which he wants.
I was on the Basel Art Board that represented the American dealers, and
for the Basel Art Fair in Switzerland.
Basel Art Fair, and they would, I had to fly out there every 3 or 4 weeks, so it seemed, at least every 2 months.
So it was demanding.
So it was, for that alone was demanding, and then I'd have to go from there to somewhere else. So I even on Christmas and Thanksgiving, I was often not around.
So now you can share some sunrises and sunsets.
The real life is.
Well, this interview was precipitated by an interview that he just gave with an author doing another book on Lee Krasner and the personal side of her life. And we both contributed anecdotes, but of course Donald had a lot to contribute, a lot more than I to contribute. And what I felt that Donald's role at this time in his life, but he doesn't really want it. He's curated jury shows and done that. He doesn't really want that. But I thought his story, kind of working on our story together.
I've done that here, you know, quite a few jury shows and, you know, for the area.
And then doing occasional interview, and I think that some kind of anecdotal memoir would be good, because there's a lot of historical fact in it.
Well, I'm going to say that we have...
I hope your listeners enjoy Donald and
we have another 90 seconds left in the show.
Well, can I tell you how much I appreciated talking to you? Oh. You're an easy man to talk to.
So are you, Donald.
You're much easier than I am, I think.
Well, I think, you know, the two of you work very well together, obviously.
Thank
over
you.
Over 45 years or so.
Right.
So it's working. You know, your love Thank of each you. Other and art and I love looking forward to seeing the new studio, Kenny.
Thank you.
I'll definitely be there.
I'm very happy to see that you say that. Thank you. We were married 5 years ago in Hudson at City Hall, and we have been and we were also married in Washington Square Park in 1980. And I am very fortunate to have a partner. See, art has connected us, you see, and I think maybe you're with someone who you don't share all the same interests, but in our case, sharing the same passions have really been part of our story, and we wanted to share that with you today.
Well, thank you, Donald McKinney.
You're
and
welcome.
Kenneth Polinsky, for this wonderful conversation. Thank you, listeners. You've been listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. This has been The Art of the Hudson Valley, and I'm your host, Chad Weckler. Continue listening to WGXC. Thank you all.